Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 168, being recorded on the 1st of March, 2017, with special guest Barry Laubrex. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan Russell from the UK, Alex Morales, who's from Florida, and of course, our special guest, Barry, who we will introduce in just a minute. And before we get there, let's just get started with the round of updates. And Russell was kind enough to put some notes in the show notes. Russell, there's one in particular you like. You want to get started with that one?
Yeah, very excited about this one. So I didn't realize it was coming, but it was announced earlier in the week. So some new updates to Azure Functions. Functions are the serverless compute that we have, the serverless compute model that scales pretty much very, very far and very wide. And the new capabilities they've announced are function proxies. So what this means is that you can now put a different kind of HTTP front end. So you put multiple endpoints onto all your functions and wrap them all together. And then you'll be able to use multiple functions that are discrete, independently scalable things, but be able to create an API front end for that set of code. Those discrete bits of compute behind don't have to be in Azure Functions. They could also be other APIs that you've got sitting elsewhere, or you can proxy to Azure Storage or something like that. But the really nice thing about this is that it opens up a sort of a microservices architecture model to you within functions, so serverless and microservices. So to me, that is really exciting and quite powerful. And alongside that, there's another tool, a third-party tool called Serverless, that allows you to do simple deployments. And up until recently, that's always been an AWS-focused tool. There's some YAML in there that allows you to provision your services and deploy them out. But that tool now is also supporting Azure, so you can provision those things from there.
So, Russell, is that basically a design time tooling at that point to make it easier to develop these, or...?
The serverless tool, well, it's an offline tool, so you use it as part of your development process. So you can use it partially to spin up a template that will say, this is what my environment's going to look like. And on the back of that, it will do all the ARM templating for you and execute that. So you can deploy your functions into an Azure resource, basically.
So basically the same concept as maybe like IIS Express for ASP.NET development. Something local you can develop the stuff against. And then
that's not actually for hosting and running it, but it's for creating the stuff that enables you to deploy it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I believe there's some tools coming that will allow you to run Azure Functions locally as well, which is quite exciting. So you'll be able to test, debug, unit test locally. That's more to what you were talking about there.
Okay. Cool. We'll definitely look forward to that. But yeah, the deployment tooling sounds nice.
Yeah, if you look at the serverless website, I mean, it's still, they've got some videos up there that talk about AWS with their tools, but it explains the whole process and in a very nice sort of 1-minute video that's very quick and easy to consume and explains what it does. How much benefit you get over what we have with ARM templates anyway, I'm not quite sure, but it's another integration. And if people are familiar with AWS Lambda and using serverless to deploy those, then they've got the same tool set that they can use to deploy the same kinds of things in Azure. So it's all very nice.
Nice and to see that whole function's getting some respect over there.
So the proxy does open up a lot of possibilities in terms of architecture now. It's very interesting and exciting. And the roadmap looks great as well. So, yeah. Very cool.
And then there was the thing about Azure Search, right, Russell?
now available in the UK data centers. Yeah. Yeah. So again, another piece of functionality getting dropped in there that I didn't realize was missing up until the announcement came out, actually.
Me neither. Yeah. I was like, wait a minute. I mean, it wasn't all over the world already. So
it's like all these things, though, you can consume them in other data centers anyway. It's not
right.
It's a PaaS service, isn't it? So it's got HTTP endpoints on it. It doesn't really matter where it sits.
Exactly. And then, I think you were talking offline about the Azure CLI, right? Which is, I think that's based on Node, correct? The Azure CLI?
Yeah.
Is that a Node implementation?
Last time I looked at it, it was, so I don't think it's changed. But
yeah. It's like that cross-platform command line interface for Azure. And I suppose the reason for the Azure CLI is because PowerShell is not available on other platforms yet, correct? Or not fully released.
No, I mean, you can't. Yeah, well, I can't remember if the PowerShell sitting on top of .NET Core is. I know it's at least in preview somewhere. But yeah, I mean, it basically is about the subset of our customers that are coming from a world that's not Windows, right? And allow them to use their same familiar tools to do this stuff. I actually, while we're kind of an ancillary subject to this, is I actually encourage people to go the other way. So if you're somebody who's primarily a Windows person, try and use CLI because it gives you a little bit more portability. And if you really want to go that next step, leverage the bash on Ubuntu on Windows that ships with, I guess, I can't remember exactly, you know, sometime last fall, right? It shipped with Windows.
Yeah, it was the anniversary edition.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, I've used that for some of the stuff. I'm trying to force myself to get better on that. It's a great experience to kind of come at this from the opposite direction, at least for me. Right, and see that I can still kind of sit in my email and other stuff while I'm doing it and not have to spin up a separate VM to use the CLI and kind of learn that approach.
Right.
Yeah, I think the CLI just comes a lot more naturally to people that are used to command line things. So developers, particularly Linux-based developers, it's going to be a lot more of a consistent kind of feel for those guys compared to going to PowerShell or anything else.
I'm still struggling a little bit with PowerShell, although I know that's like got everything, right? We know the it's always like it's got access to all the resources, whereas the CLI may be a little behind. And this update that we're just talking about, it adds some of the new things like SQL, DocumentDB, Redis. But just to show you that these things weren't there in the Azure CLI before, and they're there, and they're there now. But the PowerShell is. You're right. It does take a little bit of getting used to in terms of the syntax, you know, how you do the how you pass in parameters. Some of the error messages are super cryptic. Sometimes I get confused with them. This is definitely seems like a more streamlined way to do it.
I mean, behind the scenes, one of the things that I find is, you know, if we haven't talked about this in a while, but the kind of democratization of what we're doing with some of these cloud services and really trying to appeal to you no matter what your workload is, right? We would like you to run it in Azure or using Azure services. The more these days when I talk to my engineering counterparts, I hear more and more that they are shooting for absolute parity between the CLI and the PowerShell stuff, right? Kind of, you know, years ago it was, oh yeah, we'll ship some stuff on CLI when we get around to it. PowerShell is kind of our first class. Now they're really focused on, it's not always true, right? They don't always achieve what they're shooting for, but they're really trying to make sure that you can do everything in CLI. I can't remember which product it was, I found at least one piece of functionality in the Azure networking world where CLI has it, but PowerShell does not.
That's shocking.
Yeah. I don't know that was intentional, but we did find that when we were working on something. So
that's cool.
And I don't know if you guys saw it, but one of the demos showed someone running the CLI directly from the portal. So there will be an icon.
Click
on that icon and it opens like a blue screen, and you can go ahead and type your commands.
Kind of like the Kudu interface for web apps type thing where you can. That's nice. Yeah, that'll be great.
That's a good one, Alex.
Cut and paste what you're doing on premises, and even if you just all you have is the portal. Nice.
Yeah. And Evan, I thought you might find the Azure Data Sync update interesting, right? That's kind of down
I do. That was a product that they were working on back when I was still in that space. It's a really hard problem to solve, but it looks like they're getting closer and closer to kind of landing that because the Data Sync is really about keeping multiple databases in multiple places, either regions or just different databases in sync, without having to implement something like transactional replication or anything, which really doesn't work in the... You can do it to SQL Azure, but I don't think you can do SQL Azure to SQL Azure. I'm sorry, Azure SQL DB to Azure SQL DB. DataSync is about kind of enabling that capability. And yeah, it'd be, you know, when this goes GA, that's going to be a great, great, great functionality. Now you can have your database in, you know, the Far East in sync with your database, you know, in North America, and you don't have to do anything to make it happen other than turn this on.
Yep. And then they've added a whole bunch of things to the Azure IoT suite, which we've talked about in the past. And you know, that's they've added some more functionality to make it easier to manage these devices. In the past, you know, we've had ways where you can get telemetry from various devices, but then you know, on top of that, you want to be able to manage and push certain updates to the devices. Maybe have a common configuration between them, and so now you could set up these you could synchronize settings between you know, your cloud and your devices using this concept called device twins, so that you have you know, a common group of devices, and you could just say, okay, you know, I need, this just replicates whatever is there in these other devices. You know, it's like a, it's almost like a template, and so now you could quickly provision a whole bunch of, like, you know, literally hundreds and thousands of devices, and say these all take the same parameters as these other devices here. So just make it easier to manage a lot of devices in the IoT suite. And then, you know, I'm just happy to see them making updates to the MPI interface, the multiprocessor interface for the HPC workloads. I think, you know, we don't talk about that as often as we should, but obviously there's a lot of work going on there for the parallel processing and all the, you know, the more intense workloads that we run in Azure. And they've updated the MPI now to add support for MPI 3, which is kind of the most recent version of MPI. And so that's something, if you're doing HPC work, that's something you want to look at. Okay, I think that's, what's this update about the SQL database enables direct load of files in the Azure Blob Storage?
Yeah, so, you know, you can do, now you can point directly to, you know, JSON or text or whatever your file type is in Azure Storage, and then in Azure Blob Storage, and now you can pull it directly into SQL. You don't have to, like, write custom code to parse it, right? So if you can do it with an open row set command or a bulk insert command, you should be able to do that. And this is really targeted at kind of importing data type right. scenarios, where it's typically much quicker to just copy the file over and then write a T-SQL statement to do it than to write some sort of, you know, parsing logic and you know, do your reads from your file and then your inserts from
right,
your
right.
Database. But, yeah. Man, it's been a while since I've seen open row set. I know people still use it these days, but that's kind of going old school, but it works for this situation great.
Yeah,
I like this one from a DevOps point of view as well. If you're wanting to see the test database and stuff like
yeah,
that, then it's quite
absolutely.
A nice way to do it.
Yeah, that strikes me as kind of one of the mainline scenarios that it feels like we're going after is that kind of an ability.
Yeah.
All right, so that's a good roundup. I'm sorry, did I miss something? You want to say
yeah,
something?
No, just one other thing just to mention. It's not part of the Azure updates, but just for the sort of developer listeners, we've got the Visual Studio 2017 launch next Tuesday.
Oh, that's right.
So there's some events going on around that. I might put some links in the show notes. So I've heard there's some training and some big events going on, some sort of free live web training going on as well on the 8th. So just worth reminding people that that's the big day for that launch.
That's good, and we should do a topic on that, because I'm sure there's a whole bunch of Azure integration that goes with it, right, with VS 2017. So we should have a show or an episode on that.
Yeah, that'd be good, yeah.
All right, so we've kept our guest Barry waiting long enough, so let's turn the mic over to him. Barry, appreciate him joining. He joins us from the Netherlands, and interesting. So Gary was one of our listeners, and he reached out to us on Twitter saying that he had a specific area that he is passionate about, and he wanted to share with our listeners. And we said, okay, you know, we'd love to have that. And so, and Barry, why don't you start by giving our listeners a brief introduction, then we can dive into the area that you want to focus on.
Yeah, all right, cool. So thank you for having me on. I am Barry Luybrecht. Like you pronounced, very good, actually. I'm an independent software developer and architect, and I'm also a Pluralsight author, And I do all sorts of other stuff, like a user group that we have here in the Netherlands, in the south of the Netherlands. And I've been working with the Microsoft Azure Cloud for a very, very long time already, or as long as you can do that. And I enjoy that a lot, because I think Azure actually takes care of a lot of the plumbing for you as a developer. So it takes care of the boring stuff so that you can actually build things that matter. And you see that more and more. And that's also the case in the scenario that I want to talk about. So during my work as an independent consultant, I've seen many, many, many clients. And from those clients, I have gathered lots of knowledge, and I've put that knowledge in a Perlsite course. And that course is called Building a Global Application with Azure Platform as a Service. And that's pretty cool, because Azure PaaS enables us to do that pretty easily, however easy that actually is. So suppose you have a website like Microsoft.com, and that website actually lives within a single web app that, for instance, lives in central US. I would hope that is actually the case for Microsoft. That would be very, very cool, that they could run Microsoft.com in a single web app. But I doubt that it's that simple. So suppose you have that, then people that go to that website, Microsoft.com, they will have a performant experience. Things will work well for them. That's fun. That's fine. But suppose that I will go there. I'm in West Europe. Things will be a lot less performant. And that's because of latency. And latency is a difficult thing. You would say, how can that be? It's usually like 200 milliseconds or something like that. And that's because I have to download the content of that website, the HTML, the images and everything else, CSS files, JavaScript files, completely to my machine through a wire that goes under the sea. And although that's 200 milliseconds, that is for every HTTP request that I do. So one for getting the HTML, one for getting the CSS, one for getting the JavaScript, and so on. So that amounts up to a long time. Maybe I'd be waiting seconds, and that's too long. So you can do a couple of things about that. First of all, you can offload some of those HTTP requests to something like a CDN, for instance. You can use Azure CDN. Azure CDN is something that works over, for instance, Azure Storage. You put your static resources in Azure Storage. That's your CSS files, your videos, your images, whatever else you have that doesn't change that much. And then you put CDN over it, and CDN replicates that content to CDN points of presence all over the world. And it does that pretty cool. They actually have more points of presence of CDN than they have Azure data centers. So then that content is close to me in West Europe. So then when I go to Microsoft.com, I have the CSS files. I can download those much more quickly because, for instance, there's a point of presence in Amsterdam, so I can get to that. The same goes for the JavaScript files and any images and videos. So that's a much more pleasant experience using CDN. But still, when I then write something, or I do an update, or I log in, or I do something else on the application, it's still slow because I still have to go all the way back and forth to the US. So you can do something else with that. You can use Azure Traffic Manager for that. And the way you would do that is you would deploy the Microsoft.com website in a web app all over the world. So you would have a web app in central US, one in West Europe, maybe one in Australia, one somewhere else, wherever your customers are, wherever your users are. So as close to the user as you can. But the problem always is the Microsoft.com domain is a custom domain, and that's bound to the web app. That's bound to an IP address and a specific name for the web app. For instance, Microsoft.com.AzureWebsites.net. And the other web apps have similar unique properties, like the web app in West Europe has a Microsoft.WestEurope.AzureWebsites.net and a different IP address. So you can use Traffic Manager to put one single domain name above all that and have that point to these different web apps, to the different IP addresses, and have that then route traffic to those IP addresses based on an algorithm that you choose. So all those web apps are endpoints, and Traffic Manager pings all those endpoints every 30 seconds to see if they're healthy, so to see if they return a HTTP 200 code, and to see what their performance, for instance, is. How much latency is it from where the Azure Traffic Manager is? And based upon that, it builds a table that it then uses to route users to the right web app. So for instance, if I then navigate to the URL, which is then bound to the traffic manager, Microsoft.com. The traffic manager can then decide, it's Barry, he's in West Europe, and the least latency is for the West Europe web app, so I'll send him to that web app. And then the next requests, I will be routed to that web app as well. So I will then have a much more pleasant experience.
So Barry, would one way to look at this, a lot of times when I talk to people, I'll describe it as, kind of DNS routing that you can control. Right. You decide the rule, and then traffic manager will implement it for you. But really, there's a lot of flexibility to kind of choose whatever business rules you want to use, time of day, geographic, whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
So one thing that I've heard a couple of times, and I actually don't know the answer to this, so I'm kind of curious how you solve it. Is, let's say, I developed this website, and it's the next Amazon, right? It's just grows like crazy. What's the best way to kind of put traffic manager in front of that after I've already kind of gotten going?
Well, that depends on what your situation currently is. As in, do you have websites all over the place already?
Well, so assume I have my one website, right? Where the problem I typically see is now I've got my DNS pointing to my single website, and I need to kind of inject traffic manager in the middle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But everybody knows my old URL. They know. Is there a way that you typically recommend to tackle that?
There is ways to move DNS pointers over. Let's say your domain name Microsoft.com now points to your IP address that's in the central US, but you can also have it point to somewhere else, aka your traffic manager. And there's ways to do that very smoothly.
Okay.
But you would have to implement Traffic Manager and then implement your website all over the place anyways. And then the difficulty you would have, indeed, is then the transition from your DNS from the one IP address to the other IP address.
Right.
And there are ways to do that smoothly. Yeah.
So just look at it as a typical DNS move.
Yeah, basically. Scenario. Yeah.
Okay.
There's the usual TTL and whatnot, right, that comes into play there.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. You play with the times to live, indeed. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is about performance. When you use the traffic manager, you can make things more performant, but you also gain availability with it, because traffic manager knows which nodes are healthy and which aren't. So suppose that the West Europe web app would then die for whatever reason, or would not behave very well, then my traffic would still be routed to the central US web app. Although it would be less performant, it would still work. So it would still have a working application. So you can also use it for availability.
And Barry, do you know if it gives you, it would alert you that it detected a failure there, just so you can take some proactive action on it?
I haven't been able to actually do that yet. So not yet. Maybe with the new tools, Azure Monitor or something, that you can put over that.
Got it.
But not natively in the Traffic Manager product itself, no.
Okay.
So this is the easy part. Doing the websites, so putting your HTML and CSS and all that stuff close to the users, and then having that routed to you. That's pretty straightforward and pretty easy. But the difficult part is the data, because every website, every web application has some data that it works with. You need to read some data, you need to write some data, you name it. So where do you keep that? Suppose you have that in the central US, in an Azure SQL database, for instance. And my web app is in West Europe, my web app would have to point to that one Azure SQL database, would still be very, very slow. So I would connect still my connection to the Azure SQL databases in the US, so that will be very, very slow. You have a couple of strategies to deal with that. For instance, you could try and replicate all the data that you have all over the place, so also in West Europe and in Australia, you name it, and then have people write in that and then make some strategy to do conflict detection and all that stuff. You could do that. That's a very hard problem. First of all, there isn't an out-of-the-box functionality from Azure that can do that yet, although Azure SQL Data Sync might be able to do that. But before the announcement, I thought that Azure SQL Data Sync was actually a deceased product because it was in preview for so long. So that could help with that. But then still you have difficulties with conflict detection. And also, possibly with rules and regulations. Most of my customers, they say, I want this data to live in the US. I want this my data for these customers live in Germany, for instance, and this in the Netherlands because of rules and regulations. And although usually, if you actually look at the laws and legislation, that's not actually necessary, but still people feel the need to do that because they want security, want to feel secure that the data is secure and that the data is close to where they live, for instance. So in that case, what you could do is you could split the data over the databases that are served in the different regions. So customers A, B, and C would live in the US, D, E, and F in Australia, and so on. But then you would need a routing mechanism. So your website needs to know, your customer needs to know where to get its data. And that's also a very difficult thing, but potentially a very necessary thing nowadays with the distributed systems that we have. This is a thing that we've done a couple of times, and that's then a mechanism that we build ourselves that then looks, all right, this is customer X, and his data is in database Y with a lookup table, let's say, and an internal routing mechanism that then routes the right configuration for the right customer. In that case, you can have the customer actually choose where he has his data. And that, unfortunately, that doesn't particularly mean that that is fast, because it could be that the customer has his data in the Netherlands, but maybe he travels to through Australia, and then he still has to connect to the Netherlands, and that's then slow. But still, the majority of those customers will probably have a fast experience. So it's all about balancing that. And then a third option is to do a very popular thing, and it's to separate reads and writes. So you could have your data replicated to read-only nodes. And you could do that, for instance, with Azure SQL through Azure SQL geo-replication. In Azure SQL, you can indicate that you want all your data replicated to secondary nodes that you can put anywhere, really, in another geolocation, for instance, in Australia and in the US. And then your data will be automatically replicated over to there. I think there's a 5-second lag or something, and it works very well. Only those nodes are read-only, so you can't write to those nodes. That's a pretty good option. So reading from the databases is pretty quick, but then writing to the databases is slow. If you separate that, so if you write, you could make that not live. For instance, if you have a shopping cart experience, if somebody buys something, you could say, all right, now we have this this action. We're going to put that in a queue or on a service bus queue, for instance, and we're going to deal with that later. We're going to deal with that behind the scenes, let's say, and let the customer go on with their lives.
That's an awesome, you know, I hadn't thought about that approach, Barry, splitting up the reads and the writes, because, yeah, you know, again, depending on your scenario, right, you may have tons of reads and no writes.
Oh, yeah.
And so absolutely, if your writes are a little bit slower, it's not the end of the world if it's not the mainline experience, exactly, for you.
That's how most of the major shopping websites do it, like Amazon, for instance. They're all eventually consistent, which then means your write is somewhere in a queue, and that will be eventually written down to the database, and all of the data will be eventually consistent. So that's the implementation of the CQRS pattern, the command query responsibility segregation pattern, and event sourcing. This is very difficult and has its own challenges, obviously, but it's a good option. And for instance, I told you Azure SQL, you can do that by using geo-replication, but you can also do this with Azure Document DB, and that is kind of built for this whole scenario. So that has global database replication and works kind of similar. Also there you can say, I want my Azure document to be replicated in these regions, and that then also goes very fast. And again, you will have one writable instance, and that you could take that, you could just accept that that is slower, or you could just also there separate the reads from the writes and put the writes into a queue and then deal with them later.
Yeah, so that's one strategy. I like the DocumentDB approach. That we've been struggling with the same thing in terms of, you know, coming up with a data approach that is that has the geo redundancy, right? I think DocumentDB has the most nines availability from all our from all our data access technologies, like more than SQL Server as well. So yeah, I like that approach.
Yeah, but then SQL Server has other very cool features, like their whole disaster recovery plan, for instance, where everything is on read access geo-redundant storage, which means that all your SQL data is always replicated three times within the same region and three times in a secondary region. Mm-hmm. And it has all these cool things like automatic performance recommendations. Find that very, very cool. So if you have an Azure SQL database that's been running for a while, it starts making recommendations like, hey, should I do this index for you? That will probably be faster. Or should I remove this index for you? And you can have him apply that automatically and test that. So he will test if that actually helped. And if it didn't, he will remove the index and then test if that actually helped.
True.
The same goes for threats as well. You have the whole threat detection thing that's now in preview. And that will tell you if somebody, for instance, is doing some malicious things or if there's weird activity on your data. So there are a couple of benefits that you also have with Azure SQL. But it's just, it's a balancing act always.
And Barry, I suppose the same thing applies for mobile applications, right? The back end, yep. I guess the web API that you have in your mobile applications can also be put in front of a traffic manager the same way?
Absolutely. It's not only websites. It's basically any URL that can spit out an HTTP 200 code.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever that is, and it could also be a cloud service, actually, an old school cloud service, any app service, or any custom URL that you put in there, that all works.
So that's a key. I'm glad you mentioned the requirement of it returning a 200. I know some colleagues of mine that support Traffic Manager have mentioned to me a couple of times over the years that that's probably one of the single most common mistakes that they see customers do is, you know, they forget to make sure that whatever Traffic Manager is probing and is watching is actually returning a 200.
Yeah, I've had that many times myself, where whatever it was probing actually gave back a redirect, a 302.
Right. Yep.
And so the node is deemed unhealthy, and so you will never be routed to the node.
Right, but the rest of your pages come back just fine. It all looks up.
Yeah.
Yep.
So therefore, it's always a very good idea to have a separate health monitoring endpoint that is not actually your website, not actually the root of your website. So something that checks your health, and you can have custom logic in there. So an API that you built yourself that checks, hey, can I reach the database? Can I reach this API? Can I reach storage, for instance? And then says, all right, it's 200 or not.
That's great.
Great idea.
Barry, you've talked about replicating SQL and replicating document DB around the world. What about storage? What's the sort of common pattern that people use for replicating that data when they need it in multiple regions? What do you see happening there?
Well, luckily, that's all out of the box. So what I said, for instance, Azure SQL, that runs out of the box on read access geo-redundant storage. So that means that's storage that you can use all over the world. It will be replicated all over the world, or all over the world, in two data centers, I mean. And you can read from that as well. There is no real solution for that, like for document DB, yet. For instance, if you want six regions or something, you will really have to replicate it to multiple storage accounts.
Okay, so do you see that happening under control of the application or by some other process that runs in batch or something like that?
Yeah, usually by the latter, so some batch process like an Azure function or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So another strategy that you can use with the data that I didn't talk about is you could still have one single big database in a region that you allow your data to be in, for instance, central US, and then you can have cache, so for instance, Redis cache, caches set up with all your web apps, and then when a web app hits the database, it gets data from the database and puts it in the cache, so data for reading, and then subsequently it will read from the cache and not from the database, which will make your reads fast again and your writes slow. So you could then take the same approach where your writes will be put into a queue or something and be dealt with later. So that's a different approach where you put in caches in front of the database basically so that your data is still close to the user obviously then you have to be very careful which data can actually live in the cache in which geographical areas, because also there you will run into rules and regulations again.
And you should probably, I mean, full disclaimer here, you should probably be caching anyway, regardless of the you know, the distributed nature of it, but it just becomes more important, right,
yeah,
in the scenario you're talking about.
Absolutely, yeah.
Database is slow compared to memory, right, even a fast database.
Yeah, usually it is, yeah, unless you use, for instance, the in-memory tables in Azure SQL. It's in the
right.
Premium tier then. Then that's extremely fast.
Yep.
It's also expensive.
Right, and you still have a data network hop, right? So
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're always good to avoid that if you can, especially for the something that's used often and that can be like reference data, right? That's what you want to cache. You obviously don't want to cache customer data, but the reference data certainly.
Exactly. So things that that don't change that often that you want to cache, just
right.
Like stuff that you put in your CDN, for instance, things
exactly.
That don't change that often and are static files.
Yeah,
basically.
This is great, Barry. Really well laid down, you know, from start to finish, how you would cover all the various angles. Really, I mean, I can see that, you know, your Pluralsight background is becoming very apparent in the way you went through that just now.
Okay.
And it was very, very clear and concise. I mean, I don't know. Is there anything else you wanted to add? And guys, any more final questions for Barry? Before we let him go?
No, this is great, Barry. My only ask is quit giving all the answers, otherwise people don't have to call me. reduces the fun of my stuff. But no, you covered a lot of the common things we see that, you know, if people would do up front, right, they won't ever end up having to talk to me. So that's a good thing in general.
Yeah. Well, these are the difficult problems. These are the things that we're dealing with now. And I think as tooling and services mature, like things like Azure SQL Data Sync, and for instance, the tooling around Azure Document DB, I think this will be less and less of a problem because this will be more and more simple and automatic. You just click it and then it works.
Yeah.
It's magic of the cloud.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for reaching out to us and offering to, educate our listeners on this on global apps in the Azure PaaS service, which I think is going to make a very, very good show. So appreciate you taking the time to join us from the Netherlands, and hope to get you on some other time on some other topic.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks, Barry.
And
thanks
Barry. Guys, for all the feedback. Yeah. Take it.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.